Poet, MacArthur genius, and president of the Guggenheim Foundation, Edward Hirsch encourages us to look to the past for inspiration.
All of the poetry behind us is available to us, and in all different languages. They carry a kind of knowledge, a kind of information you can't get anywhere. So why not go to them?
Prepare to be inspired as this author of the best-selling book, How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry, shares some of his own knowledge and reads from his book, The Living Fire, New and Selected Poems, today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and I talked with Edward Hirsch when he was at Rockhurst University's Fall Midwest Poet Series after the release of the Best American Poetry 2016. David Lehman chose him as the guest editor, not just because of his skills as a judge, teacher, and author of 9 poetry and 5 prose books, but because when basketball star Kobe Bryant announced his retirement with a poem, Lehman's mind jumped to the hookshot in the 1986 award-winning book, Wild Gratitude. Here's Edward Hirsch with the story behind that one-sentence poem, Fast Break.
I was teaching at Wayne State University in Detroit. My first teaching job, my closest friend was someone named Dennis Turner, who taught film. And Dennis and I played pickup basketball together. And one day, he had a stomach ache, and he had intense pain, and we took him to the hospital. And he went in with intense pain, and when he came out, it looked as if he had a diagnosis of primary liver cancer, which it turns out that he had. And we were driving back from the hospital. I'd picked him up. He said, listen, if I have liver cancer and I die, you owe me a poem. So I said, well, that's some assignment. Not that glad to hear about it. And he said, could you try not to make it too romantic? So I thought that was super funny.
Yeah.
So anyway, after Dennis did die, I was heartbroken. And over the course of the year, I felt I had this task to write a poem. I really didn't know what to write about and how to do it. And I got the idea, because we'd played so much basketball together, of writing an elegy for him about basketball. And then I also had the idea in this poem that I would model the poem on a play in basketball. Rather than writing a sonnet or a sestina or a villanelle, I would try and see if you could make a sentence that would model something in sports, which I hadn't seen before. And so I got the idea of trying to run a single sentence that would unfold like a fast break. And it took me so long to figure that out that I kind of forgot about Dennis. And then over the course of the poem, as you see, I think the poem is about basketball, but it also becomes an elegy. And I would say that's what's characteristic of it. It is a play in basketball, but it's also an elegy for my friend.
Well, let's hear you read it.
Fast Break, in memory of Dennis Turner, 1946 to 1984. A hook shot kisses the rim and hangs there helplessly, but doesn't drop. And for once, our gangly starting center boxes out his man and times his jump perfectly, gathering the orange leather from the air like a cherished possession and spinning around to throw a strike to the outlet, who was already shoveling an underhand pass toward the other guard, scissoring past a flat-footed defender who looks stunned and nailed to the floor in the wrong direction, trying to catch sight of a high gliding dribble and a man letting the play develop in front of him in slow motion, almost exactly like a coach's drawing on the blackboard. Both forwards racing down the court the way that forwards should, fanning out and filling the lanes in tandem, moving together as brothers, passing the ball between them without a dribble, without a single bounce hitting the hardwood, until the guard finally lunges out and commits to the wrong man, while the power forward explodes past them in a fury, taking the ball into the air by himself now and laying it gently against the glass for a layup, but losing his balance in the process, inexplicably falling, hitting the floor with a wild headlong motion for the game he loved like a country, and swiveling back to see an orange blur floating perfectly through the net.
That's so wonderful. I mean, it has that
feeling of fast movement in sports, and yet you're doing honor to him. That's the poem Fast Break by Edward Hirsch, and it was originally from his book Wild Gratitude, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award when it came out back in 1986. And it's now in the Living Fire, New and Selected Poems, which covers your career.
Mm-hmm.
I have to ask, the poem that precedes this in the book, Omen, was that about him as well?
Yes. The poem Omen was the first poem that I wrote after I got the assignment and Dennis was sick in the hospital. But after he died, I realized the poem was wildly romantic. And so it didn't fulfill the assignment. But yes, it's also about Dennis.
I love the fact that it's juxtaposed to Fast Break. Was it actually juxtaposed in Wild Gratitude as well?
It was. That was my idea. I mean, the Omen, it's not really about Dennis. It's about my own grief that my closest friend is going to die. It's a kind of pre-elegy. Fast Break, which is a later poem, a cooler poem, really, I mean emotionally cooler, is more objective, and he's already died, and it really does become about him. This is about my own grief. That's why I felt I had another poem to write.
Did your friend Dennis get to see Omen?
No, he was too.
He didn't want that kind of poem anyway.
He didn't want that kind of poem anyway, but really, he was very sick. I mean, the knowledge in the poem is he's going to die.
Yeah.
And I was just grief-stricken.
Can we hear that one, too?
Sure, my pleasure. I lie down on my side in the moist grass and drift into a fitful half-sleep, listening to the hushed sound of wind in the trees. The moon comes out to stare, glassy, one-eyed, but then turns away from the ground, smudged. It's October and the nights are getting cold. The sky is tinged with purple, speckled red. The clouds gather like an omen above the house, and I can't stop thinking about my closest friend, suffering from cancer in a small, airless ward in a hospital downtown. At 37, he looks boyish and hunted, fingered by illness, scared. When I was a boy, the summer nights were immense, clear as a country lake, pure, bottomless. The stars were like giant kites casting loose. The fall nights were different, school-bound, close, with too many stormy clouds, too many rules. The rain was a hammer banging against the house, beating against my head. Sometimes I'd wake up in the middle of a cruel dream, coughing and lost, unable to breathe in my sleep. My friend says the pain is like a mule kicking him in the chest, again and again, until nothing else but the pain seems real. Tonight the wind whispers a secret to the trees, something stark and unsettling, something terrible, since the yard begins to tremble, shedding leaves. I know that my closest friend is going to die, and I can feel the dark sky tilting on one wing, shuddering with rain, coming down around me.
The poem Omen from The Living Fire, New and Selected Poems by Edward Hirsch. And this is New Letters on the Air.
One of my friends taught this poem recently, and he said, my class loved it. Super pathetic fallacy. So that was really funny. I don't know if you know what the pathetic fallacy is, but the pathetic fallacy is something that John Ruskin termed in the 19th century, in which the poet projects his feelings onto nature. And here, that's absolutely the case. It's not like Victorian poetry. In this case, I think it's more like tribal poetry, archaic poetry. The whole world is grieving with you, and you project it into the seasons, into the fall, of how now the season is coming down around you in your grief. And Omen is in that state of being grief-stricken. Fast Break is
now, more of a celebration.
It's something later. And I really had an assignment now not to make it too heated, not to make it too romantic, to write something for him. And basketball seemed to be the way to do that.
Yeah. Well, I love the fact that you just explained pathetic fallacy. I did know what it was. But, you know, for people who wouldn't know what it was, you have a wonderful book called A Poet's Glossary. And I'm sure if I looked up pathetic fallacy,
yeah,
I'd find
there.
It in
yeah,
there.
It's there.
I wish people could see it. It's over 700 pages. But it's really a wonderful dictionary of literary terms for the poet. And I believe this book came after you got the MacArthur Genius Fellowship, right?
Yes, much later.
It is such a huge work, as is How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry, which also came out after you got the MacArthur.
Yeah.
I just wondered if that freed you up to be able to work on this, or were you already working on it in your academic life?
I mean, the MacArthur really helped me tremendously, especially because How to Read a Poem was already finished when I had gotten the MacArthur, but it really helped me with the advocacy of it because people said, well, now a genius wants to help us read poetry. But Poets Glossary is not related to the MacArthur. What's really happened is I wrote How to Read a Poem for both initiated and uninitiated readers. And at the last minute, my editor convinced me to put in a glossary, which he thought would be helpful, of specific poetic terms. I was very reluctant to do it, because I really tried in the book to write the book without specialized terms. But sometimes you need them. I mean, sometimes you need to describe a meter or what a metaphor is. And so I put this in the back of the book, just using the terms that had come up in How to Read a Poem, just the terms that are in that book. And then it turned out that this part of the book, the glossary, is one of the most widely used part of How to Read a Poem, because many people teach how to read a poem. I didn't mean it to be a book that was particularly taught. I meant it to be a book for readers, to help uninitiated and initiated readers understand more about poetry and to go more deeply into how poems work. But the glossary was really helpful to teachers. And then the teachers began saying to me, but there are certain terms that are not here. I go, well, it wasn't meant to be a definitive glossary. It was just meant to be the terms I had, but it began to weigh on me. And so over time, I got the idea, well, wouldn't it be interesting to try and do all the terms, to do a kind of encyclopedia of terms, and to try and make the book more international instead of just American terms from American and English poetry, to see what you could do if you actually did as many languages as you could manage. And the problem of it just began to absorb me. And so I began to work on it. It took me a long time, but I really liked the work on it. And I began to put in a lot of things that I'd never seen in other dictionaries before about poetry, especially internationally. There's a lot in my book about tribal poetries, about Latin American and African and Slavic poetries, Greek and Latin as well. Anyway, I just found that the universe of poetry is very rich and very wide, and every culture has a poetry. So it began to really stimulate me to see what I could do, and this is the result.
Well, I think it's wonderful because one of the things that you do in A Poet's Glossary, and you certainly do it in How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry, is that you are considering, you said the initiated and the uninitiated, but you're also considering the poet and the reader. You reach out to the reader as much as you do to other poets.
Oh, and much more. In fact, you've hit on the basic premise of the book. How to Read a Poem is not written from the point of view of the writer. It's written from the point of view of the reader, and that I stand in for the reader. And the basic premise of that book, as you know, is that poetry does not have its meaning unto itself, that poetry has its meaning in the relationship that's established between the poet, the poem, and the reader, in a kind of relationship or connection. And I read a lot of poems, but I also try to think through what that relationship is and how poetry works. And that the reader had been, I felt, neglected in our thinking through how poetry works. Because I think there is no poetry without readers to read poetry. And the poem sort of has its meaning when it's actualized in the reader. So I take the role of the reader throughout the book. It's really a reader's book.
Yeah, and I think that's what made it. I read that it was a bestseller after it came out.
I had a feeling that there was an audience of people. I mean, you have to be of goodwill. You have to have some interest in poetry, otherwise this book is not going to appeal to you. But if you have some interest in poetry, but you'd been turned away in some way, you thought it was too difficult for you, or you thought you couldn't understand it, you thought it was too academic, I had a feeling there were a lot of people like that, and that what these readers, they didn't know a lot about poetry, but they didn't want to be condescended to. And I felt that if I could reach out to these readers, that I would find an audience. But it also had to be accurate for poets. So the poets also recognized what you were talking about, that you hadn't in any way dumbed it down or simplified it, but that you had sort of gone a long way in a kind of democratic way to make the case on behalf of the reader. And so my book begins with readers reading poems, that as the reader, what is your contact? How do you read it? And my idea is that if you begin with a kind of naked contact with the poem as the reader, eventually all the subjects, all the themes of poetry would deliver themselves to you. And that's sort of how it unfolded.
Yeah. I'm talking with Edward Hirsch today on New Letters on the Air. I love to, and you do this in your poetic work as well as the nonfiction, how you bring examples or make allusions to other poets. And yet, especially in the nonfiction, you're right, you don't do it in a condescending way. It's kind of an opening, a window for people to climb through and into the world of literature.
I think if you're taught poetry in a certain way, it's as if the Norton Anthology wrote all the poems and it just kind of blurs for you and it's just an academic exercise. But when you live with poetry, the poets are sort of part of your extended family. And if you think of them as people who wrote poems and you know more about them, then it's sort of like, these are some odd aunts and uncles that I've got here in the history of poetry, and some of them come in different languages. And so because poetry means so much to me and because I've spent so much time with these poets, I call upon them in a somewhat familiar way. I think that's part of your experience. So in my own poems and in my writing about poetry, I don't pretend that other poets don't exist. In fact, I do call upon them quite a lot to help guide me, but not in an academic way, not in a cold way, but in like, let's see how they can help us understand these poems and think through our experience.
Yeah. It's how you continue to have, as one poet I interviewed, the Irish poet, Sinead Morrissey, said that she likes to think of herself as having a conversation with other poets. You
yes.
know, whether they're still living or not, it's conversing with them through her work. And I thought, you certainly do that.
That's very much the case.
Well, let's have a poem where you're conversing with another poet. Let's skip ahead in The Living Fire. You have a whole section in one of your later books that refers to a lot of myths. I like this one. It's from the Hades sonnets because it also pulls in some ancient work, but puts it in a context with your father. It's called The Forgetfulness Chair.
In Lay Back the Darkness, I'd written some poems trying to get at things that I just hadn't been able to write about. And I thought, well, what happens if I try and go through some classical stories? I especially love Book 6 of the Aeneid, where Aeneas goes down into the underworld to see his father one last time. And there's that heartbreaking encounter where he tries to embrace his father, but his father's smoke. He can't hold his body. And I love Dante's Inferno. And I just wanted to see what would happen if I started to see if I could get at something that I wasn't able to write about for whatever reasons. I'm not really sure. But these stories opened up something for me. And so the Hades sonnets, those poems all about going into the underworld, just offered me something. And I just decided to follow it. And in this one particular, it goes through a classical story, but you'll hear how personal it is in my getting at something about my father. The Forgetfulness Chair. My obstinate, self-absorbed, courageous father, shuffling across the living room floor to the determined chair in the far corner where my mother covered him with a blanket, and he promptly dozed off and woke up later without knowing where he'd awakened, was Perithous slipping into the underworld through the open gate at Tynarum to abduct Persephone, the queen of death, while Hades, the unseen one, coaxed him into sitting down on the chair of Lethe, the stony black seat of forgetfulness, where he forgot why he had entered hell and never found his way back to the living.
That's The Forgetfulness Chair from the Hades Sonnets that was originally included in Edward Hirsch's book, Lay Back the Darkness, and is now in his new and selected poems called The Living Fire. And you're listening to him today here on New Letters on the Air.
I was really grappling with my father's Alzheimer's and his dementia and his pacing. And I didn't know how to think about it, and I didn't know how to write about it. But I was tormented by it. And the story of Perithous came back to me. And I thought, what would happen if I try and write about Perithous? And that's how these two things came together. My father's dementia and the classical Greek story of Perithous, who thinks he's going to outwit death and isn't able to. And the forgetfulness chair that he sits in struck me as a tremendous metaphor for a kind of dementia.
It's a wonderful metaphor. And I think something that so many people can identify with, because dementia is a very...
It's brutal.
Brutal is the right word for it. That's very touching. You have a whole section of the Hades sonnets where you explore different myths and relate them. When you're working on a poem, especially when you're looking at something that's very personal in your life, like you just described, how do I approach this? In this particular time, were you already working on some poems that had to do with Greek myths, or did it just come up and you gathered them together into the Hades sonnets?
It usually comes from desperation. I mean, you just can't figure out what to do. And you're trying hard and you just keep bucking your head against something, you can't get it right. And many people see these ancient myths as something academic or something to study, but I believe they carry a kind of wisdom. They carry a kind of truthfulness to you. And by sometimes going through myths, you can get at something that you find hard to get at otherwise. That if you give yourself to the myth, it's not an academic exercise, but it can be a personal one. And that's what happened in some of these poems. And the idea of making them one-sentence sonnets, which is the one I just read you, was stimulating to me. I thought it's interesting to see if you can make the syntax operate through across 14 lines with one sentence. It has a kind of rush, but it also has a kind of archetypal form.
Yeah. And again, this shows us you having a conversation with things that have come before, too.
I mean, many people think of this as very literary or academic, but it's never seemed that way to me. I love the moment in Dante's Inferno where he calls on Virgil to help him. He's going to travel down into the underworld, and he needs a guide. Now, of course, he's his own guide in a way because Virgil's long dead. But in a way, it's saying, look, help me. I'm trying to write an epic. And I need an epic that's come before me to help me. And so, in a way, the Inferno relies on the Aeneid. And that's always been moving to me because there's something abject about it. Because Dante says, look, I can't do this all myself. I need some help. I need some structure. And I've always found that the poetry of the past, which intimidates some people, is available to us that way. And sometimes it will inhibit you, but sometimes it's available to you and it enables you to do something that is just too hard to do on your own. And so you call upon some beloved immortal, some poet from the past, someone you've befriended, even though you don't know personally, to help guide you through something. And that's what happened in these poems.
Yeah. It's a wonderful thing. You use the world as your toolbox.
You know, Ezra Pound once said, all poets are contemporaneous. And many young poets now are not interested in the poetry of the past. They're only interested in poets writing now. But I've always felt that all of the poetry behind us is available to us and in all different languages, and that they carry a kind of knowledge, a kind of information you can't get anywhere. So why not go to them? No, sometimes they don't help you. There are great poets who I love to read but don't help me at all, who put me off. There's great poets who I admire but don't connect to. But there are also poets that you feel are yours, and they can be very stimulating to you. And I'm always encouraging young poets to find their own poets out of the canon, to find other poets from the past who speak to them, and that I think that can help you in your own work.
Definitely. Did this come to play at all when you were reading through all the literary magazines, searching for who you wanted to include in Best American Poetry 2016? I mean, because you must have read. Have any idea of how
painful.
Many?
It was painful. It's hard to think about. I read all the magazines for a year, but I should confess, I read all the poetry in all the magazines. I can't, you know.
You only have so much time.
I just wasn't reading all the prose. I'm sorry to report. But yes, I was reading all the poems. And Well, I mean, I don't think you're looking for the poetry of the past. You're looking for something that happens in language.
But I mean, were you looking for poets who recognize that relationship? I guess not, because in the foreword you were talking about, there were just some poems that you read, and then later they stuck with you.
Yeah.
So it could have been a turn of a phrase.
You know, I happen to like forms, and I happen to like shapes, and I think something has to happen in language. So I was looking for poets, not because of their references or allusions to poets of the past, but I believe a poet is a maker, and a poem is a made thing. And I was called to poems that have been shaped and that have been made into something. But even then, I wouldn't say that was the defining feature. What you're looking for is something indeterminable that you can't forget, that something is at stake for the writer, that then becomes at stake for the reader. I would say what characterized most of these poems in the best American poetry is that something is at risk. There's some experience that the writer cares about, small or large, but it really matters to her or to him. And then it's been transformed and grappled with in poetry. It's been shaped, it's been turned linguistically so that something happens on the page when you read it. And the poems that I found myself going back to after reading, you know, thousands and thousands of poems, sometimes I put them aside because I knew who the poet was. Sometimes I put it aside because I was just interested in what it was. Sometimes I thought the subject was interesting. But the ones that stayed with me were that something seemed seriously to be worked out by the poet, and then something had happened. It wasn't prepackaged. Something was being thought through in front of you, as the forms were instruments of discovery. And that's what I was looking for, poems that were trying to discover something that was meaningful. There's so much fooling around in contemporary poetry now. There's so much noise that I was looking for things that really had some substance. Now, sometimes they're funny, and many of the poems made me laugh, but something's happening. Something's at stake.
They're on some level transformative.
That's right.
Well, you know, we were very thrilled to see that Deborah Marquardt's poem made it in there, published in New Letters, and then Michelle Boisseau's poem.
I love
fun.
Both of those poems. Michelle's poem really begins with that story about George Eliot and goes on to the root of the word ugliness, and it thinks through ugliness, and then it transforms into how George Eliot had a kind of beauty. But it also thinks through how something seemingly ugly can be beautiful. And Deborah's poem is a remarkable ode to North Dakota. It's called Lament. And it's funny because it addresses North Dakota and say, North Dakota, what are they doing to you? But it's also extremely poignant. I didn't know another poem like that, that a poem that speaks to a state and that yet brings into a kind of tremendous political dimension of what people are doing in terms of the boom, the oil boom in North Dakota. It's a very original poem of social engagement. But it also was funny to me because it was like, oh, my poor North Dakota, what are they doing to you? And it speaks to North Dakota as if North Dakota is a person. And that's the nature of the ode.
Edward Hirsch on the Best American Poetry 2016, the year he was a guest at Rockhurst University's Midwest Poets Series. We heard from The Living Fire, new and selected poems, and talked about his poet's glossary and his bestseller, How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry. For links to these books and to the other half of this conversation about his book-length ode to his late son, Gabriel, or an archive 1991 interview with Hirsch, visit newletters.org, a production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC. Today's show was produced with Megan Schwindler, Danny Moran, Blake Elizondo, Mackenzie Callahan, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.